Have you ever wanted something so badly it nearly destroyed you? At 41, after a 27-year break from tennis, I stepped back onto the court with a cheap racket and outdated technique. What started as casual hitting sessions spiraled into an all-consuming obsession, a quest to see how far a middle-aged woman could climb in competitive tennis. That first tournament victory felt intoxicating, the trophy gleaming on my mantelpiece. All I wanted was another one, a desire that would push me to the edge of physical and psychological collapse. This wasn't just about tennis. It was about reclaiming something lost, proving something to myself, finding objective validation in a world where success often feels arbitrary. I abandoned tennis at 14 when I went to boarding school, trading my identity as the tennis girl for something safer, more acceptable. At my new school, lacrosse ruled, and during my first tennis lesson, I experienced what athletes call choking. My arms turned wooden, my coordination vanished, and I developed the elbow, that dreaded tension that transforms fluid movement into mechanical jerks. Another student who barely cared about tennis defeated me handily. The humiliation felt absolute. Rather than face this new reality, I reinvented myself completely. I started using my middle name, Victoria, marking a clean break from my tennis past. I took up ballet, horse riding, embraced lacrosse with forced enthusiasm, and adopted typical teenage rebellions, smoking, obsessive dieting, anything to distance myself from that failure. Yet tennis never completely left me. The racket stayed tucked away like a secret, and in casual games years later, muscle memory would resurface, proper footwork, instinctive ball trajectory reading. These scattered moments created a complex tapestry of unresolved emotions and unfulfilled potential that would eventually demand resolution. But obsession, I would learn, comes with a price. My first serious tournament shattered every romantic notion about competitive tennis. After booking the Lester Hilton and researching opponents, I arrived at a desolate industrial estate filled with middle-aged players in ill-fitting clothes. Natalia demolished me with powerful topspin and devastating serves, 3 aces in her first game alone. I lost the first set 4-0 in a blur, later discovering she'd been ranked in Spain's top 20 as a junior. The consolation draw brought its own indignities: frozen astroturf, negotiating to avoid matches in the dark, boring rallies where neither player committed. Yet I immediately began searching for more tournaments. My coaching relationships mirrored these internal conflicts. Dan had me pretend to be a peacock while he pretended to be a dolphin, bizarre techniques that somehow produced good topspin forehands. Then I began secretly training with Josh, who offered more structure but called Dan's approach old-fashioned. When Dan discovered my sessions with Josh, the hurt in his eyes was unmistakable. Josh eventually became my primary coach, pushing me to exhaustion in 2-hour sessions, then confirming what I'd feared. Dan's just holding you back. This triangle of divided loyalties became emblematic of my entire tennis journey, constantly torn between competing approaches, never finding the perfect formula. My body screamed warnings I ignored. A sudden stop nearly broke my toe, the nail turned black. Micro tears riddled my calves, my knees ached, my arm throbbed. My osteopath laughed when I complained about my right side failing. I was playing tennis about 20 times a week. During the Canterbury tournament, I dragged myself through matches with concrete calves and collapsed arches. Mosquito bites became infected, spreading in circular patterns that baffled nurses. I received antibiotics, steroids, antihistamines. The rash haunted me for 3 years. I cycled through diets obsessively, dropping below 30% body fat, looking more athletic than ever. Tennis had become a rectangular sanctuary where I could hide from life indefinitely, safe within invisible walls, even as my body systematically broke down. The red line from shoulder to fingertip should have been enough. It wasn't. I played tennis as I lived life, safely, without risk. Deep down, I didn't want to crush opponents. I wanted tennis to be beautiful, cooperative, eternal. During a session with Lee, I finally committed to my A game, breathing properly and hitting every shot with intent. I won 6-3, 6-1, and immediately decided to quit teaching to become a yoga teacher. Tennis was revealing truths I couldn't ignore. My anxiety had plagued me most of my life, worsening after an abortion in my teens. My 45-minute commute became unbearable. I'd shake, cry, fear losing control. Heading to Maidstone, I experienced vertigo crossing a bridge. What if the problem wasn't outside me, but inside? On court, the mental challenges were equally brutal. In Nottingham, I thrashed one opponent 6-0, 6-2, just playing and having fun. Next day, facing another player in blazing sun, I was constantly distracted by thoughts of ratings and heat stroke. I clawed back to win 11-9 in a tiebreak, squandered 3 match points, then finally won. It was the hardest match I'd ever played, mentally. Afterward, I felt oddly empty. Winning felt like carrying a small, fragile bird. Open your hands too much and it flies away, close them too much and you crush it. Less than a week before Seniors Wimbledon, I was vomiting from nerves. My preparation had been chaotic, visiting my hospitalized father, playing endless matches when I should have been tapering, obsessing over white outfits. Walking through the players' entrance at the Arangi courts felt surreal. 20 perfect grass courts, luxurious changing rooms with white towels and attendants. On court 17, nerves silenced me, but my strategy worked brilliantly. I beat the second seed 6-2, 6-2, savoring every moment afterward with all England club toiletries, feeling a belonging I'd never experienced. My semifinal the next day was on remote courts. No audience, no atmosphere. Though I won the first point, it was the only game I won. I left quickly in tears, sobbing in the shower. Despite nearly making the national top 10, I felt like a failure, an outsider again. I decided I must give up tennis. I was too old, too inexperienced, too prone to psychological collapse. After Wimbledon, I discovered I was ranked 6th in GB and 131st in the world for my age group, a world-ranked player. Then, during a hitting session with Dan, everything started spinning. I nearly fainted, insisting it was just anxiety. Soon, I felt faint every time I visited the tennis center. Like someone dancing the tarantella or wearing enchanted red shoes, I simply could not stop until I could barely stand up anymore. My nervous breakdown began with those dizzy spells and spread everywhere. Despite being incredibly fit, I was plagued by palpitations, panic attacks, and an inability to function. Recovery took over 2 years and 56 therapy sessions, where I processed past traumas, the 1989 abortion, family issues, my stepfather's death. The most important lesson: overcoming anxiety requires not being afraid of it, accepting what is. I still don't fully understand why my joyful obsession turned destructive at that particular moment. I've tried returning to tennis, but never overcame the anxiety of competing. Do I miss it? Hell yes! Tennis gave me something my writing career hadn't: objective achievement. Those cheap trophies meant more than my L Style Award or Orange Prize nomination, because I won them based on points, not judges' opinions. What began as a desire to improve became a quest for validation. I wanted to be so good that everyone stopped to watch. Instead, I discovered the limits of my body, mind, and talent. Yet, I also found unexpected joy in the pure physicality, in hitting a perfect shot, in the camaraderie of fellow obsessives. The most valuable lesson was learning to hold that fragile bird with just the right touch, to care deeply without being consumed, to strive without destroying myself. In the rectangular sanctuary of the tennis court, I found both my limits and my potential. True success lies in understanding when to push forward and when to step back, when to fight and when to surrender.